The time for empty talk is over. Now arrives the hour of action.
It's time for the John DePietro Show here on News Talk, WNRI, 1380 AM and 99.9 and 95.1 FM.
He's a special kind of sentinel.
Mr. DePietro, who is in the eye of the storm.
Suddenly, John DePietro became the story.
Radio talk show host, John DePietro.
All right, here we go. Welcome to the lunchtime. It is Political Monday. Good afternoon, one and all. Here I am. It's Juan. It's John DePietro. Weekdays, we start at 11. We go till 2. It's AM 1380, 99.9 FM. You can always listen online at either WNRI.com, DePietro.com. This portion of the program brought to you by Brood Awakenings. Coffee House, five locations in Rhode Island. Two in Johnson, one in Cranston, one in South County, Warwick. You know, I think everyone's passed by a Brood Awakenings, but maybe didn't stop in. You're thinking it's just coffee. You'd be amazed, impressed, so much more than just a cup of coffee. Location offers a lot of seating. Very comfortable seating, by the way. Nice and clean. Plenty of seats. Flat screen TVs. Nice, comfortable chairs. Very convenient time to stop in, do your work. Now, coffee was the start 23 years ago. Now you get fresh breakfast sandwiches, lunch sandwiches all day. Two of the locations have drive-through. Two have full liquor licenses. Stop in. Brood Awakenings. You're going to love it. And again, those five different locations. Well, folks, let's bring them on every Monday at this time. We do Political Monday. And joining us right now, as I said, he is the managing editor for OceanStateCurrent.com. We want to say good afternoon and happy Veterans Day to Justin Katz. Good afternoon, Justin.
Good afternoon, John. Thanks for having me. And thanks to any veterans who might be listening right now.
That is exactly right. Hey, Justin, I want to start off. This is one of those things where a lot of times people knock the fact that print media has fallen off, and it has. You can't deny that. And the Providence Journal doesn't have the circulation they once have and certainly don't have the number of reporters they once had. But, you know, if you don't have this, this isn't an area that television news dives into a lot. Maybe Ted Nesi pulls this apart sometimes at WPRI.com. But the situation with the pensions in this morning's Providence Journal, and I love the fact that Kathy Gregg takes the time to go through it, lay them out, who these people are, how did they get that. I'd like your thoughts on that, and then I want to touch on a little bit that I just think it's one of those things that because of the system we have set up, no one will change it or reform it because it's kind of like an arrangement that the judges, judiciary that benefits the most, that they have with the General Assembly. And that is that so many members of the General Assembly, especially the powerful ones, we saw recently Mattiello was in court. You know, think what it's like when he goes to court. They used to talk about when John Harwood used to be in court, the judges would refer to him as Mr. Speaker. Completely unfair, uneven balance. But it's kind of this game that the judges certainly give leeway to many members of the General Assembly who are attorneys, and it helps their law practice. And in exchange for that, the General Assembly allow these very, very generous pensions. And I want to point out to people that these are things you would never see in the private world corporations, as far as, you know, people not paying into them. But just your thought on the pension story in the Providence Journal.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The entire system is sort of built against reform, right down to, as you mentioned, the lack of real incentive for news media to get this kind of in-depth on these stories. It does take work. It does take some understanding. It's easy to get wrong. And it's hard to get information out and difficult to change. But some of the high numbers, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it wasn't just judges in the article. Some of them, so you've got Stephen Perret, who is carrying a six-figure pension and also working for the city of Providence for six figures. To me, the biggest scandal of it all is it gets down to what are these pensions supposed to do? And it's, as you say, it's so blown out of proportion. Anything people get in the private sector, they're trying to set people up so that they never have to reduce their standard of living. They never have to downsize. They're essentially making what they make in retirement, what they were living on when they were working. And it's just not a sustainable way to go about doing things. And you mentioned, you know, the deference shown to the speaker in court. But I always remember with these, when these pension reports come out, is especially with judges, it sometimes it seems like a path, especially on the Senate side for some reason, where you're in the Senate for a while and then you become a judge. It's just kind of how it works. And so there's the appointments to become a judge is controlled by the legislature. The judges get these giant pensions and it's impossible to reform. And it really does raise a lot of justifiable skepticism about who our government's really set up to form, to benefit.
Without question. And a lot of times what people also need to understand is, you know, there are certain people that get picked out, you're right, and identified as someone that's going to be on their path to a judgeship. It's the Senate that approves the judges. You know, years ago, it was a speaker that told me, we get the budget, they get the judges. But and who do they pick? They reward one of their own. One of the most abuses was when, you know, Bevel Aqua became the Chief Justice of the Rhode Island Supreme Court, and he had just been a legislator, and suddenly there he is, you know, at the top of the court. But the system is designed, they're going to put someone in there who I would describe it as basically is with the program, right? Montalbano became one. There was a lot of talk that Teresa Piva-Weed wanted to become a judge. Different people have written, it's the pedigree of, you know, for so many years, it was you attended LaSalle Academy, you went to Providence College, you went to Suffolk at night, and then you became a legislator, and then you got to become a Rhode Island judge. That was the path. But they basically want to put someone in there, not necessarily someone that deserves to be on the bench and knows the law. It's people that's going to kind of keep the system going. There's certainly, you don't see them pointing or bringing in a lot of outsiders, someone who has not been part of it. There's a special code up there. I mentioned, you know, Montalbano. That was his goal from day one. But it doesn't serve the public. But I you know, you did have Deborah Gist, excuse me, you had saw Gina Raimondo when she was treasurer step in and try to reform the pensions. But they wouldn't go near the judges. They went after the teachers and so forth. But they wouldn't go near the judges. In this day and age, you're exactly right. What purpose does it serve? Is it to give them something to, you know, live as they're retired? Or some of them, even seemingly, especially some of the firefighters or the COLAs they had, they start earning more than what they earned when they were working. It seems that the system was never built for someone like this. Steve Perry, you know, why is he collecting a pension if he's still working? It just, I don't understand what the purpose of it is, other than it just seems like a total, if you can grab it, then grab it.
Right. Well, what it has become is a way to essentially delay some of their compensation for the rest of their lives. And that's why they get upset when there's a reform, because they don't consider it as here's how the government and my employer is going to try to take care of me in my retirement. They consider it as this was part of my job, a delayed pay for what I was doing. And if you talk to a lot, especially on the higher end, a lot of the, you know, superintendents, judges, a lot of them think they really do believe themselves that they're giving something up to be, take this public service position, and this is their reward. They get it in retirement. You know, of course, a lot of the time, if you look at the superintendents in particular, in my view, if you were out in the private sector, you wouldn't be running a $50, $75, $100 million operation. You only get to do that because you're in the public sector. But they think it's their just reward, and so the fairness of it goes right out the window. And I think what the public needs to focus on is this, if you can leave your six-figure job in your 40s, 50s, or even your early 60s and go out and get another six-figure job paying on top of that, that's not the purpose of the pension. Something is fundamentally wrong there. And that's where the good work of having journalists out there at least reminding us of all this stuff is very important.
You're exactly right. And I also know, you know, a couple of years ago, they kind of follow in a pack. Something that I think is, you know, no one really has the guts. It's a longer conversation, but to take on is really what is the role of the Rhode Island State Police? The Rhode Island State Police first started, it was my understanding, it was basically because there were some communities in Rhode Island that were small and didn't have a police force, and they basically started that way. Now you have all of these local cities and towns have police forces, and then you have the Rhode Island State Police. It's very political. Basically, for the most part, you have to know someone to get in. I'm not saying all the time, but you certainly have a lot of sons of troopers that get in. The trooper was in. Their father was in. It starts to become rite of passage, almost the same way, You know, there's certain, you know, firefighters. The grandfather was a firefighter. The father becomes a firefighter. The sons become firefighters. Same thing with police. But with the state police, where it's mandatory retirement at age 25, several years ago, you had a trooper that got a job with RIPTA. So what happens? The first thing he does, he hires five other troopers that just retired, and boom, they all get six-figure jobs, as you said. I've also sometimes spoken with employers who said that they've talked to the brass of the state police, and they said, hey, we understand you have an opening, so-and-so trooper's retiring, and the person that was telling me the story said that they almost took the phone call that it really wasn't a request. They were almost being told, you know, it would be good for you and your business if you would hire this trooper that's, you know, coming out. You also just saw very recently Joe Philbin, number two or three, I think, in the state police. I thought it was a little odd, retired over the weekend. None of this, he's retiring in a month, retiring in 2 months, whatever. Suddenly he just cleans out his desk over the weekend. But then he even floats out, hey, if there's any municipality out there that wants a chief, I'd be happy to come in. He's 52 years old, and he's going to be retiring, I would imagine, with a pension that's pretty close to, if not six figures. It's And some of these guys, you know, he could easily live 40 more years. So, Justin, it's the cycle of the system was never designed for you work 25 years, and then now you're going to receive a pension for 30 to 40 years. You receive a pension longer for the amount of time you put in.
Right. And when they're so substantial in the amount that they get, that you really end up paying two, three, four times for every position that you have in your government. You're not only paying for the person who's doing the work right now, you're paying for the last two or three people who did that work for the rest of their lives, as you say, and people are living so much longer. Now, it does become such a huge benefit it creates this atmosphere, as you just alluded to with the state police, of a feeling of almost implicit corruption. And it starts to make people not trust in how their government's operating, especially when they retire and then they take another job across the border. One of the people highlighted in Kathy Gregg's story was Troy Earhart, and apparently he was an ed commissioner, but he bought credit for the years he worked in Massachusetts. So he's getting a pension from Massachusetts.
Yep.
He bought credit in Rhode Island for the same years that he's getting a pension in Massachusetts. So you're talking in Rhode Island alone, he's making $136,000 a year into the pension. That's just really not it's just so abusive. And so when you hear about how concerned they were about the wholly inadequate reform that Governor Raimondo spearheaded when she was treasurer, that the little changes there, and yet we're still, 50% funded or thereabouts, because the pensions are just so generous. And what they really ought to be talking about is reforms where you don't get a penny until you're 65, 70, something like that. That's when you start collecting your pension. Or if you get another job, it's delayed. These are the things that really, really have to be done. And they won't be, because they're just, there's such a, the state is so chock full of people who are benefiting or hope to benefit from this system that the reform is almost hopeless.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right with complicit corruption. And it even comes back to, as we've talked about, I mean, when Social Security was set up, it was 65. The average life expectancy at the time, for at least for men, was like 67 or 68. So it was almost like, you know, you'd retire at 65, you'd live just a couple of years and then pass away. Now, forget about it. And then, never mind, I remember years ago, I went to, was with a friend, and we played golf in Jamestown. And one of the biggest abuses is the in Newport, it was like a golf tournament, and I was meeting all these guys at the Jamestown golf course, and which is only nine holes, but it's fine, it's perfectly adequate. And I would say all of them were under the age of 50, and they had all retired from the Newport school system, and they were all getting a full pension. I mean, it was just never designed for that. And I think you raise a good question. I want to jump into the situation. Speaking of the media, last night you had the first presidential, well, I think Elizabeth Warren spoke at Brown, but Mayor Pete came out, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's still certainly in it, and in some polls he's kind of come up a little bit, but he had an event last night at the Veterans Auditorium, and first they were secretive about where the location was going to be, then they let out the location, but the media was not allowed inside. and different people were tweeting out different pictures. I think I heard a little bit of audio. The media was allowed to talk to people in the line, but I just don't remember the last time that was done. It's certainly making big headlines right now as I'm looking that Don Jr., Donald Trump Jr., on his book tour did an event last night, and the audience got upset because he wasn't doing a Q&A. But the media was not allowed into the Mayor Pete event. And I was trying to think, you know, and I mentioned earlier, Bernie Sanders 3 years ago came to Temple of Music, Rhode Island Park for the Rhode Island primary. He had 8,000 people. Obviously, anyone could go. Hillary Clinton, she did an event at CCRI. Bill Clinton was there. Then she was at Central Falls. The media was there. Trump did the rally in Warwick. What is your thought and what is the reasoning behind? Why would the media not be allowed in with someone who's running for president, and never mind someone who's not exactly like the front runner?
Well, I think there are two aspects here. One is it depends what kind of event the campaign is trying to have. So if they're coming in and trying to build up support, get some headlines, they'll very often have public event the media can go to, and then they'll do some one or multiple fundraisers in the area to collect money. And it's understandable, as we saw a few years ago when Mitt Romney ran, it's understandable that they want to keep some of those events quiet because you want to be able to say things to your donors that the public might not be very happy to hear. It's not always a good practice, but you can see why the politicians would want that kind of privacy. But what's interesting here is the lack of a public facing event. And some people have complained about that in the state about, you know, it's as if he's coming here to collect some money on his way to somewhere that actually matters. And that's probably got some validity. But I think also too, there's a chance, and he's a guy who's trying to build a buzz as somebody he's on the cusp of getting into the top tier. He's not quite there. So he doesn't want to have an event and have it be, the reporters come in and talk about how many empty chairs there are, for example. So that might be another reason. But the backers of it, of his event are kind of interesting. They're an interesting mix of kind of progressives and more moderate Democrats. So it's curious where that's all coming from. It would have been interesting to hear what his presentation was to this kind of various group.
I agree. I just think you're running for president. You want to try to let as many people as possible hear your message. Here's where I'm going to be. I'm going to give a speech. And then anyone that wants to come, learn more about me, hear me, boom, they can come. When you close it off, I don't know how else you look at it. As several years ago, someone used to say a lot of the Democrats just treat Rhode Island as an ATM machine. They come in. It is a private event. They just want to collect the money. They want to get the hell out of there. I think last night it was interesting. You have people like Joe Paolino, who's there. Well, I think he just covers all his bases. I think Joe, no matter who's coming in, is willing to write a check. I know he's impressed with Mayor Pete. But then you saw like a very progressive, like Justine Caldwell, rep in East Greenwich. She was there, which is surprising because I would think she'd be more on board with like a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. But there are some people that again, the media, I don't think the media got into, but a big part of the draw was whether or not it's to his credit or what speaks to it, but he is the first openly gay individual who's running for president. And I think to not include that in the coverage, I'm not saying that's a reason not for people to go see him, but I think you should point if that is the reason why. And a lot of times if you see some of the people that were standing in line where they drove from, that is something that they wanted to go and see this individual, and they wanted to hear from him. And I don't know enough about it. There was a man standing on stage with him. I'm not sure. I think it could have been his husband. I'm not sure if it's his husband. But I think I don't understand why that wouldn't be illustrated in that way, and also why the picture of him with a man on stage isn't identified as his husband, if that's who it was, and I think it was. But I thought that the press coverage of his visit was a little odd and unusual, and I don't think the press did their job for not highlighting if that was a big draw for why people were going to see him. Not that, again, I'm not trying to point out in any way, implicate or imply there's anything wrong with it, but the same way if someone was, you know, when President Obama first came and visited Rhode Island, you had these stories of these, you know, older people of color that were saying they dreamed of the day when this would happen, and that was their reason for going to see him. And I think, in speaking to someone who kind of covered some of the stuff and saw some of the people outside, they felt that was a huge part of why a lot of people came and wanted to be supportive, and yet there doesn't seem to be any mention of that in the media.
Well, the news media, which I don't think it's controversial at all to say anymore that they're pretty uniformly Democrat, pretty uniformly liberal or progressive. They're in a kind of tough situation right now with all of these candidates vying for that same kind of space. So I think they're probably being very careful about what they highlight in each candidate's particular identity, particular brand, because you do have multiple very progressive people running against each other. Then you've got Buttigieg, who's got some progressive angles, but maybe he's a mayor, so he may have a little bit more, credibility among a more moderate, operationally focused supporters of Democrats. So I think that probably explains at least some of that reluctance to get into anything that might conceivably be controversial, because on the one hand, you don't want to tank that candidate, or the media doesn't want to tank that candidate. But on the other hand, they don't want to highlight something that might make him more competitive with somebody who's farther to the left, like Elizabeth Warren. So it's an interesting how the Democrats are going to pick and choose among these candidates as the field narrows down. I think that's going to be very interesting, and I think that might be part of what we were seeing in the coverage of this particular event.
Folks, we're speaking with Justin Katz. It's John DePietro, managing editor, OceanStateCurrent.com. This is Political Monday. Justin, not front page, but inside the Providence Journal, name change. Barbara Ann Fenton, politically active wife, Cranston's term-limited Republican mayor, Alan Fung, confirms she has filed paperwork to have her surname changed to Barbara Fenton Fung. It'll be official later this month, she said, and then the Journal writes that they feel that it sparks more talk that she's looking at some kind of a political run herself. So Barbara Ann Fenton suddenly now becomes Barbara Ann Fenton Fung, which is a long name, or maybe it just becomes Barbara Fenton Fung or Barbara Ann Fenton Fung. But either way, a lot of people know her as BA. What is, I'd like your thought on that. She is definitely someone to watch. She is a female. She is anyone that's met her. She knows politics. She was very involved with the campaign. People know her because her husband, Cranston Mayor Alan Fung. But I'd like your thought on the name change and just in her in general.
Well, I'm not sure how to read this one. She quipped in the newspaper that her mom thinks she's going to damage Alan's brand. I'm not sure which way that goes. I mean, he won in Cranston, so he's that might carry. If she's running for a mayoral position, that might be a benefit to her. But on the other hand, being not having a direct Fung kind of family line kind of an implication in a candidacy, that could be an advantage. So I'm not sure where to go with it. These personal family decisions, as they mix with political branding, they get kind of messy to analyze, and it's hard to know what people are thinking. So as a default, I kind of go with the explanation of she wasn't sure what she wanted to do with her personal branding when they got married, so she kept her name, and now she's moderating that by having the hyphenated name. I think it's I don't know that I'm quite ready to read anything very specific into it yet.
All right, we can disagree. This signals me that she's going to be running for something. He enjoys approval rating in the city of Cranston somewhere north of 70%. And now again, that's just Cranston, but if you talk about a lawn sign, now whether or not what office she runs for, there's been speculation. It could be she happens to live in the same district as House Speaker Mattiello, so she could run for that seat. He certainly, in the new year, could have his problems with some one court case that's coming up, and then another one that there's some kind of grand jury going on. And then there has been speculation that she could run for mayor. This signals to me that she is going to run for something, because if you think of a lawn sign or a brochure and it says Fung Mayor, I come back to that after 2010, there was a certain percentage of people, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was significant that when they were voting Chafee governor, they actually, you know, we can laugh, but they thought it was the father that was running. And so I think I'm going to go out and say I think it is strategic. By the way, I think it's a very good strategic move. I do. I think it's something that she could have or should have adopted. I don't want to say should have, but I just think it's a smart move because I think she is going to be politically active. I think she's very impressive when you meet her. She handles herself tremendously, and especially who's out there right now on the scene as far as women that do interviews. If I were to kind of go across the border a little bit, Bob Rand Fenton, who's soon to be Bob Rand Fenton Fung, she is in a league of her own as far as if you want to just talk about women on the Republican side that you interview. I know Susie Yankee. I like Susie Yankee. When you interview her, which I've done, it's, and this is, I know this may sound like a criticism, but it's just all talking points. She does not veer off the talking points. That's fine because you want to be disciplined that way. There aren't a lot of other female now, women out there that give, you know, a very strong in an interview. Barbara Ann Fenton, I've had her fill in on this program. She can handle herself in a lot of different ways. I think if she runs, she could be a force. You know, there was a lot of attention drawn that the new co-chair of the Trump party or Trump organization of Rhode Island, Doreen Costa, was fired from Channel 6 for abuse and blah, blah, blah. And something that was kind of lost in that, I think, a little bit was the fact she said, well, she had, in July, was a guest on Lively Experiment. Now, as much as it's not something to beat Hummel over the head with, but what does it say about the Republican Party that you're going to basically a salesperson from Channel 6 to be on the panel to discuss the Republican Party? That shows me there's a vacuum. There's an opening there for someone. And I think that the name change, I think it's smart. I think it is strategic. And I think that if she finally then makes the decision to run, that she is going to be a force and be she's just a different caliber of individual that we haven't seen in a while. I'll give you the last thought on this, then I want to touch on some other things.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that. And of course, it's right that just the familiar name alone is worth some points on the ballot.
It is.
That's why people invest in yard signs, especially during general elections and especially presidential years. You get people who go in there, they vote, they want to vote for something on a national ticket, perhaps, or even a bond question, whatever. They've got something specific they want, and they feel like they have to vote on the others, and they usually will just, or very often will just pick, that one sounds familiar for some reason, that
yep.
feels kind of good to me.
That's
I don't know
right.
why, but I'm gonna, so, and so, I mean, I know in Tiverton there are four, or three John/J. Edwards's frequently on the ballot, and you do have to wonder how much overlap they're giving each other, where people don't know which one they want to vote for, so they vote for all of them. So you get that familiarity, and it is worth something, especially in a place like Rhode Island, which does have a tendency toward dynasties in some regards. And so I could definitely see that being a reason for it, and I think it's a good move, as you do, if she is looking to move into politics.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I'm still leaving open the possibility that there's just, you know, this is just how they're handling their family business right now. And I'm always wary of trying to read tea leaves too much. But you probably have a bit more insight on this particular question than I do.
Folks, it's John DePietro speaking with Justin Katz, managing editor at OceanStateCurrent.com. Our segment is Political Monday. Justin, how about this headline? Rhode Island mayors decry New York homeless program. There was a piece in the New York Post that a handful of homeless families were taking advantage of this Family Relocation Act. The New York City, they're so desperate to try to get some homeless people out of New York, they actually say to them, we have money set aside. We will basically export you anywhere else in the country you want to go. And so some of the places that some of these homeless family, and I can't stress this enough, we're talking about just a couple of people, ended up were in fact Providence, Pawtucket, Woonsocket, North Kingstown. So what do you have? Providence Mayor Jorge Elorza, Pawtucket Mayor Don Grabian, Woonsocket Mayor Lisa Baldelli-Hunt. They're not pleased with the arrangement, and they say that they should have been notified by the city of New York that they were relocating some of these homeless people to Rhode Island. Governor Gina Raimondo's office did not respond to a request for comment. The Journal asked the Lorzo office what the city would do if in advance they had planned to come, but had not heard back. So all they wanted to do was almost express outrage that homeless people were coming here. I think the irony there that's lost is Alorza opens up the state of Rhode Island, specifically Providence, to anyone in the world that wants to come here. But for some reason, he's against homeless families from New York moving to Providence and or the other mayors with Pawtucket and Woonsocket.
Well, my cynical view on this is that they're mainly upset that they weren't told in advance, because then they could have registered these people to vote, which is what they're really after, is find out who they are so they
That's right.
can help them out. I'm not sure what the posturing is here. As a citizen of the country, I wish we could come up with a way that states with good policies could export their people to states with bad policies, instead of this is almost the reverse. People who have been failed by this city of New York, and who are implicitly taking a sort of a welfare payment to go somewhere else and live for a year, may not have the most, I don't know, let's say small government values when they go and they vote in a new location. There's a lot that I find kind of disturbing about this program. So I can understand why a statement would be made. But as you point out, it's a small number. It's one family in Woonsocket, one in Pawtucket, and three in Providence. There's also one in North Kingstown, but nobody down there has raised a stink about it. It is a small number. I'm not sure what they would do if they had advance notice, unless it's just, get them on the Rhode Island gravy train for through UHIP in order to get the welfare benefits here, so everybody can make sure they get the maximum credit for giving out money.
That is exactly right. That's a good point about not being contacted. And especially, I could see, that's New York ways of dealing with it, which is, you're homeless here, we have this money, it's actually cheaper for us to get you basically to leave the state. Do you have family somewhere that if you could get some money to go live, that you'd actually go and live where your family is? And then someone says, yeah, I happen to have some family that lives in Woonsocket, or I have a brother that lives in Pawtucket, or yeah, my sister lives in, Providence. So I think that, all right, fine, that here's the money and you just go, and then they hope they get adopted there. I was thrown at them being so outraged about this and actually even issuing statements and so forth. You can tell Raimondo didn't want to get anywhere near that. Speaking of Governor Gina Raimondo, Justin Katz, end of last week, we learned that New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, it sounds like he's being recruited by very wealthy Democrats to relook at, even though back in the spring he ruled out running for a number of different reasons, suddenly now has opened up the door. It would be a very interesting strategy, in fact, if all of this goes forward, and that is, it sounds like he would skip the first four contests, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. He'd skip all of those and put all of his money, which he has a lot of it, on Super Tuesday in March, which would make a lot more sense. But one of the things that the Raimondo people certainly wanted to get out there was that Bloomberg's, one of the people with him, not the former mayor himself, but someone connected with Bloomberg, called Governor Gina Raimondo, who is chair of the National Democrat Governor Association, and they wanted to clear that he had called her to kind of bounce it off her. So then that gets her into the equation, and then she wouldn't give an endorsement, but said she's a big fan of his, kind of piggybacks where she's been telling that piece in the New York Times, she's a different type of Democrat. It's not easy being a moderate Democrat. Kind of trying to lump herself in, they're the same type of Democrat, kind of like a techno-Democrat. It's more about jobs. Certainly not Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. But I'd like your thoughts on Raimondo being you certainly wanted it public that he called several people, by the way, or at least his aides did. It just says like a courtesy. He's looking at maybe jumping into the race, but they certainly wanted it made public that they had been contacted.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, she's quoted directly as saying that she could see herself getting more involved in the presidential race once she decides who she's going to support, which sounds pretty nakedly to me as like a request for bids, so to speak. Once I decide who I'm going to support, I'll become more involved, meaning what are you going to offer me for my future in Washington or in my political career moving forward? Set boundaries on that. I mean, if there are candidates who are just way too progressive for her, which is kind of hard to believe, at least on the surface, then maybe she wouldn't necessarily advocate for them. But I'd expect, and again, it might be too cynical, but I'd expect that she'll end up deciding who she's going to support, and that candidate will also, it turns out, you know, have some role for her in the future, whether it's continuing with the Democratic Governor Association, those kind of organizations, or actually in an administration or in a campaign. So that's what it jumped out at me there, is that willingness to say, you know, my approval is valuable and I'm still open to providing it to somebody for the right price.
And Justin, you know, you're exactly right about her saying, you know, I think I am going to get more involved with the national race. You want to talk about someone whose sole focus should be on Rhode Island. When you think about it, I mean, it's really now just a year that she got reelected. She's got three more years. And to me, this signals again, think of all the problems going on in the state right now, between whether it be DCYF or the UHIP problems that persist, or the problem now with, you know, the complete mess of IGT and Twin River, the test scores that are still terrible. Everyone focuses on Providence, but it's really statewide. And yet, basically, she is, like, ready to get out the door and hit the road. Like, my work is done here in Rhode Island. I'm ready to move on. And, I mean, if there's one person, the least popular governor in the country, is ready to hit the road and figure out who she wants to try to support to, hopefully, if they get elected, get a job with. I think it just signals. I mean, she is, to me, bordering on almost checked out of her job just as the, you know, the Rhode Island governor.
Right. Well, that's not only this story. That's reinforced again and again. It was last week she was out in the news talking about how the great hard work they did to win a Democrat seat, a Democrat
in Kentucky,
governor.
That's in right. Kentucky,
which I kind of joke was Matt Bevin was one of only two governors in a country with a lower approval rating. She has the highest disapproval rating, but he had a lower approval rating. So now she's gone and made herself one step closer to being the most the least approved governor in the country. But the idea that she's working so hard to change the governorship in Kentucky, it does. It gives you that impression. Well, where are you on the local stuff? Is it what, you know, why did you even run last year except to be able to continue on the Democratic Governors Association and build your national brand? There is that sense of being checked out. Partly could be a little bit of a bias of the media to report things that are national and therefore they kind of bigger news. And so that just gets her the headlines. But you don't get that sense. You get the sense that this is where her focus is. This is what she wants to be doing. And that's where she's concentrating. And it starts to make you wonder what kind of decisions she's making. And so IGT, was that because is she helping out a potential donor on a national level by getting this contract, or is it really what she thinks is best for her state? These questions start to arise when you have a governor who's so obviously focused on a national scene.
Oh, yeah. And that is part of it. You know, that was why it was so important, this IGT deal, is because they did help her. They did donate. Don Schweitzer did help her raise money. It is true that she had some success raising money for the National Democrat Governor Association. They were in need of that. But what I don't think enough people were reporting was a big part of that fundraising came through Don Schweitzer, who she made the treasurer in IGT. I mean, that it shows you hand in hand where, to me, that is, I think it's a very obvious quid pro quo that took place, which was, listen, you know, reward us with this 20-year contract extension, which is not up, that we don't need, for $1 billion. And tell you what, I'm going to help you raise money for that. They did. And we'll, you know, help you in this year of being head of the National Democrat Governor Association. IGT, to their credit, they kept their word. They stepped up. Now the only problem is Raimondo has to deal with some of this fallout. What do you make of the fact of the Republican Party and Brandon Bell? I'm so glad that he is following through now and attaching that Brett Smiley phone call to the ethics complaint, because I'll tell you, Justin, I was also glad last week the Providence Journal in their editorial mentioned an investigation, because I still don't understand why this has not been investigated. People talk about quid pro quo, and I think it's comical on the national front. The New York Times is saying, you know, we should really stop using the term with the president, quid pro quo, because a lot of Americans don't understand Latin, and so therefore people don't understand the phrase. But what Brett Smiley did was, if we're to believe the head of Twin River, president of Twin River, Mark Christofoli, excuse me, his rendition was, Smiley said, listen, we're going to give this no bid to IGT. And if you are a team player and remain quiet and look at the big picture, you're going to get taken care of. If not, I want to remind you, we are your regulator. We can make life difficult for you. And Christofoli and Twin River ignored him. They said, we are going to make some noise. And Smiley followed through with his threat. And in August, they did, in fact, make life difficult for Twin River. And then Raimondo's been trashing them ever since. I for the life of me, I don't understand. To me, that is threat of extortion, and then they carry through with the extent of extortion.
And it's kind of a no-brainer from a political point of view, or even a good government point of view, if you're the governor. There's so much room there to say, well, I don't know, it was probably a tense conversation, and maybe people misunderstood things that were said, so let's investigate, get everything on paper, and then somebody objective can look at it, and we'll go from there to see what they say. But none of that. I mean, it goes right in line with all of the peculiarity of this entire deal, to the point of, we've discussed before, how cold she's been to Twin River in general, when this is a partner of the state and will be for the foreseeable future. A lot of these things don't add up. And it's good that the Republicans in the state are pushing on it. It'd be better if it were, you know, raised much more broadly, and everybody around us say, we're kind of wondering what's going on with this? Because right now, stepping back a little bit, it does look a lot like the governor wanted a deal for national reasons, and Twin River wasn't ready to play along, and people did the kinds of made a bad kind of bad decisions of threats and what have you that they make when they've got a big political deal that's falling through because somebody won't play ball. And that appears to be what's going on here, and it's not, you know, it's not that difficult to clear up if there's nothing going on. And I'll tell you, it does also color a lot of other stuff that the governor's doing, such as, you know, right now another controversy is the marijuana regulation, which would allow the General Assembly to have a role in picking who can sell it. Well, the governor has no credibility to be out there saying, oh, we need this on an executive branch, because otherwise they'll be, you know, doing corrupt things in the legislature. Well, you know, this IGT thing is really coloring your own credibility with respect to corruption. So that argument doesn't quite fly anymore.
I agree with you. And follow up on that, Justin, because right now, everywhere, well, not everywhere, I have so many people that are buzzing about what's going on behind the scenes regarding these cannabis licenses that are going to go out. Even the FBI put out, you know, a warning sign, and Rhode Island's one of the states to watch. You're exactly right. It colors it, and it just starts to become, there's so many, I think that the faith in people with government at Rhode Island right now is back to an all-time low. People feel that there are secret deals going on, which there are. People feel there are no-bid deals that are happening, which there are, like the Board of Elections no-bid deal, which follows the IGT no-bid deal. Boy, nothing erodes public confidence more than a no-bid deal. And then why should we think that the whole situation with the licenses for these cannabis places are going to be done on the up and up?
Yeah, exactly. And I think in one way in this whole episode shows how cynical, rightly cynical, Rhode Islanders are becoming, is this idea. The Raimondo administration is claiming that the regulatory process is much more open and available to the public than our own elected representatives. So either she's full of it, or it's a huge indictment of the General Assembly that they are not. This is where we're sending people who are supposed to be representing us in relatively small numbers to debate things and come up with policy that's good for the state. That ought to be where there's the least corruption because there's so many of them. They should be competing politically, so there should be a lot of tension and a lot of watching each other's backs. And we don't have any of that in Rhode Island. And I think you're right. We're at a point now where it's almost a grab what you can. Nobody really cares. Nobody's paying attention. Democracy is completely broken. I mean, that's the feeling you start to get watching all these headlines flow across the computer screen.
It really is, and we're going to end on that note. But, I mean, I am hearing that from people, that what happened with the Board of Elections, people are speculating that somehow, because it's Cranston, there's nothing about that Board of Elections lease that makes sense. It's a no bid. The space had been, was it 300-something people working there? Now it's just going to be 17 with the Board of Elections. That's a no bid. There's a feeling of, you know, Raimondo, well, she's got her no-bid deal with IGT, so then the Speaker, he gets a no-bid deal. This, none of this is productive, and it just festers cynicism. And I agree, just going back to what you said, which was, you know, I warned from this. You wonder of why, and we know why. Why did she run for another term? Because she wanted the two terms. She wanted to be the head of the National Democrat Governor Association, which she was. But I think in the new year, If Bloomberg, we don't know what's going to happen with him, but if he starts to make some inroads and start to, you know, gain some ground and really become viable, I could see someone like Governor Raimondo out there on the national front as a surrogate. It's not Laura Stern Hurwitz. She always sees Cicilline out there. He would like to have someone like her, you know, venture capitalist background, female, governor of the state two times. I can see her, like, enough of this and now starting to head out on the trail with him to start to really make inroads and build her national brand. I'll give you the final word.
Oh, yeah, that is clearly one path available in the future where we'll see Governor Raimondo flying around the country, probably claiming to do state business wherever she goes, and possibly on the path toward being a vice presidential candidate. Who knows? That might be what she's looking at right now. And it'll be good to be through this all, and hopefully, you know, if we look over to 2020, and at some point all those decisions will have been made, and hopefully the state can move forward, as her slogan said, after that.
You know, one last thing, Justin, and it is, I think it is him. I don't understand. So Mayor Pete's husband is Chasten Buttigieg. They got married last year. I don't understand. Channel 10 has a story. I haven't checked everyone else, but I'm just, Channel 10 has a story, and they have presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg visits Providence. So there's a picture of Pete Buttigieg, and then if you Google, it's clearly his husband, and they say presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg visits Providence, WJR, and nowhere in the story does it identify that man as his husband. And I don't understand why, because I'll look through, but I'm willing to bet if they had another presidential candidate and they had their spouse with them on stage, they would be identified in the story. I don't have an answer. I just tweeted at the reporter from Channel 10, but why wouldn't you identify that that's his husband on stage with him? I don't have an answer for that, but it just seems odd because otherwise it's like, why is Mayor Pete just standing on stage, and then who's that guy with him? That it's not a Lord, it's not Cicilline, it's no local politician. There's just some guy in a rust-colored sweater with glasses on. But then if you look at him and then Google, it's clearly his husband. Anyhow, listen, folks, he is the managing editor of OceanStateCurrent.com. It's Justin Katz. Justin, great to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, John. I look forward to it.
All right, folks, there it is.